This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Frustration over immigration policies in D.C. spills over into a Charlotte City Council meeting. The 200 protesters want local officials to take a stand. Governor Roy Cooper calls for a $1 billion boost in state spending. Busing for choice, the CMS plan for diversifying magnet schools, has a price tag. The question is, can we afford it? And 100 shots are fired downtown in advance of the CIAA tournament final game, and it registers barely a blip on the radar. What does that say about where we are in the world today? We're joined by Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Michael Tomczyk from our news department, an infrequent guest host on this program, is here as part of his final day at WFAE. You may want to rethink this because you can't wear that to work where you're going. welcome to the program.
Thanks, Mike.
Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal, where he is senior staff writer.
I can keep dressing like a slob because I'm still in journalism.
I'm going to talk to you about that, by the way. And Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, who just looks splendid this morning, rounds out the panel. Thank you for being here. You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, since last fall, the number of demonstrations around the country about all kinds of things has crept up. And the latest group of protesters in Charlotte were protesting this past Monday the presidential policies out of Washington about immigration, but demanding action by local leaders. About 200 protesters marched from Marshall Park and then spilled into the city council chambers, which made it impossible to conduct business.
The next item on the agenda is a transportation action plan. At the February 13th meeting, move approval. Adoption of the Charlotte Walks Plan. Move approval of item 9.
Second.
First motion, second. All those in favor, raise your hand.
Aye.
So council adjourned, but...
By the way, somewhere Cicero is smiling with pride.
Yeah, but that's an obscure reference. So council adjourned, but Mayor Roberts and several council members spoke with protesters in the government center lobby following all this. In a nutshell, what do they want, Tom Bullock?
Well, they want the city leaders to take some kind of a stand against the what they see in particular as an immigration crackdown by federal agents and the involvement in the Mecklenburg County's Sheriff's Department involvement in a controversial voluntary program known as 287G. And what that program does is it allows certain deputies to be used to help enforce in different ways federal immigration laws. And, you know, it's interesting because the protests, you know, they've been steady here, especially on this issue. And it's important to note, you know, they have the right to do that. City Council, I'm sure, did not appreciate the fact that they had to stop their meeting. But protest is a key part of our democracy. But the key question here, I think, is are they asking the right people to do the right things? And they want the city government to take some kind of a stand. But they have a number of issues with that. First of all is a 2015 law passed by the General Assembly and signed into law by then-Governor Pat McCrory that bans sanctuary cities in North Carolina. And the way that our state is set up, a city council has to follow what the General Assembly says. We are what's known as a Dillon Rule state, another obscure reference, Eric. I know.
That's not Bob.
But
Matt Dillon.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you.
But basically what it means
Rumblefish.
Is that the city is nothing – but a subdivision of the power of the General Assembly. They have to follow that law.
Right.
And they can make stands, but now, you know, in terms of a resolution or something saying, hey, we support you, but the city faces a risk there. And that risk is this. There is a new bill that is working its way through the General Assembly that could withhold certain tax money from cities that the General Assembly deems to be sanctuary cities. And for Charlotte, that could mean around $20 million a year. So the city council is kind of stuck between, the predominantly Democratic city council is stuck with a key voting group that they want to court and actions that could cost the city quite a lot of money.
And they've already made so many friends in the legislature, they're not likely to move in that direction anyway, given what they've done, the disagreement we have over bathrooms in HB2 and the city ordinance.
Well, the city had already tried to become a sanctuary city, and the state law came along and pretty much nixed that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair overall assessment, but it's important to point out there really is no set definition of sanctuary city. But what the city did was have the CMPD not ask immigration questions. And that is still policy. The state law does not demand that police forces ask immigration questions. It just stops a city or any municipality from barring their police from asking those questions.
So, Eric Spanberg, I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, you were there on Monday night at the council meeting, is that right?
I was. I was not yelling, but I was there.
So describe what happened. I mean, when did they begin to take over the meeting? How much business was conducted before it was stopped?
Well, not a lot. You know, council has a policy where 10 people can speak. You can sign up in advance. 10 people can speak, 3 minutes each. And, of course, there were a couple hundred people there, a lot more than 10.
Right.
Now, most of the people who were angry and wanted to speak, had not signed up. And so that's when things began to get unruly because the audience was demanding a forum to share their stories. Council was saying, look, we have this rule. We've gone through the procedure. And at one point, the council left, or most of the council and the mayor left the dais to try and regroup. The city manager came out and pleaded with people to be patient and told them council would come back. And that's what led to this alternative plan, I guess, where the city attorney said, you can't adjourn this meeting and then start a new meeting because you would have to have 48 hours notice under meetings laws. And that is why they decided to adjourn the meeting and then go upstairs into the lobby and hear people's stories.
And they could not clear the council chamber. The meeting has to be open to the public. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's why they didn't just clear the chamber and proceed
you
on.
You can, depending on how disruption is defined.
Oh, yes, yes.
Bring
I'm sorry,
the police
but
in to
in
lead
terms
people
of
out.
But that's to people, that's what
right.
I meant,
but that's,
yes.
again, that's a yeah. really talk about something that's going to escalate the situation.
Right.
And I think that's what we're seeing throughout with this immigration situation is that we have confusing and contradictory information. We have lots of different government agencies involved, and we have this intensely polarized and distrustful atmosphere. And that's affecting local government, that's affecting news media trying to cover it, and it's playing out in the public schools. That, as we were doing this show last week, students at Geringer, several hundred of them went out to march around the school, and at the end, several hundred of them went back inside, and about 100 hit the streets and walked 7 miles to Vance High School, and the district, meanwhile, was locking down schools all along the way. This is continuing. We know there are still protests. None of them have gotten out of hand, but this week there are still protests at schools.
Are the students participating in these at risk of disciplinary action on the part of the schools?
They are, and again, that's why I think educators are in such a difficult situation, because you have a segment of the public that says they are there at school to learn this curriculum, and you should not be allowing them any time to get off topic on protests. And if they defy the rules, if they step off campus, if they refuse to get back to class, whatever, suspend them, punish them. And people who are opposed to these protests are additionally distraught, I think, at the fact that many of the students are carrying flags from Mexico and Central American countries where they or their parents come from. They say they're trying to show pride, show we're real people, our voices need to be heard. But you hear a lot of this, you know, they should be showing the American flag. Mm. So on the other hand, though, you have educators, I think, and members of the public who are very sympathetic, who are saying these are young people who are learning about America's civic process. And sometimes things cross a line and then there will be some issues, but they're saying we need to use this. We need to, rather than crack down and say, go back to class and don't talk about this, we need to use it constructively, which is why we're seeing continuing events during the school day.
It's like 1968 all over again. Michael Topsick.
Well, off of Ann's point about the confusing information, I mean, we saw at the public conversation that, Mike, that we hosted earlier this week. I mean, it was so clear. One of the sheriff's main roles, Mecklenburg County Sheriff, who was part of that, was just to repeat over and over and over again, my deputies are not part of these ICE raids. We are not rounding people up. Our involvement with the system is as part of the 287G program that Tom mentioned, where we are essentially checking people once they are in our jails to see to see where they are from, essentially.
He was very clear about that during our public conversation, and yet yesterday, and you covered this, Tom, and you had a report on it this morning, he gathered reporters around him to make sure everybody understood what the process was and what their participation in the process was. Was that as a result of What was that a result of?
Well, he said straight up that this was a result of the rumors that are out there. He said he wanted to, the words he used was dispel the rumors of the sheriff department's role in any immigration crackdown. And we actually only spoke with Sheriff Irwin Carmichael for about 3.5 minutes, and then he left. And we then went on a tour of central booking, which showed us how the 287G process goes through. And the key thing is the sheriff keeps saying that this is about safety. This is all about, in his words, the safety of his deputies and the safety of the million-plus people who live here in Mecklenburg County. But there are questions here. He brought up three really, I'd say big-ticket examples of why 287G was a success. All three were foreign nationals. All three were charged with committing serious, serious felonies. But he left without taking any questions, and that leaves a key point unanswered. And this is something I brought up in the story, which is how does knowing the immigration status of these three incarcerated individuals make anyone safer? You've already arrested them. And that's one of the key questions that I still have.
Didn't they discover the crimes, the alleged crimes, as a result of asking them what their country of origin was? And then how do they discover the crimes then?
Because after they are brought to the Mecklenburg County Jail, they are asked a series of questions. And two of those questions will trigger what is called a 287G interview.
Right.
Those two questions are, where are you a citizen of or a natural of, and where were you born?
Right.
And if you don't answer USA to either of those two questions, it triggers the sheriff's role. And the sheriff's role, to be clear, the deputies, specially trained deputies, are there only to ask questions and do interviews. And then if they determine or they believe that someone is in the country illegally, they notified U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, otherwise known as ICE.
Let me re-ask my question. So how did they discover that these individuals were guilty, allegedly guilty, of these heinous crimes in other countries?
No, the crimes were committed, they said here.
Here, okay. All right. Michael.
Just one last point on this immigration piece, and we've talked about it some, is the idea that so much of the focus among protesters here locally is on local government. And during the public conversation, I mean, we essentially had some people calling for Charlotte's leadership to disobey state and federal law. And you have Charlotte's leadership and even also some people in the audience who are upset about these things saying, why aren't we talking to our state lawmakers? Why aren't we talking to our federal lawmakers? And I think that's also a part of, Ann talked about, students learning about civics in America. Look, part of our country is that we are set up where we have to follow laws. And if you want your city to just blatantly disobey the law, guess what? A judge is going to rule that unconstitutional. And also think about the precedent that sets. If we can now decide, okay, we're not going to follow federal or state laws we don't like, what if we had decided that back in the 60s with the civil rights law?
Are they right when they say the protesters were saying other cities are being more favorable toward this and taking a stand against
because the federal government? Because they can. Because they don't have a Dillon rule. Yeah, they don't have a state law that forbids them from doing it.
But it's still unconstitutional.
I'm sorry?
It's still unconstitutional.
Doesn't
federal law trump state and city laws?
Well, I want to draw an important distinction here. And yes, there are other cities like Los Angeles, like San Francisco, like Seattle, where you don't have the state laws that we do here.
But they're putting federal funding at risk.
But President Trump has threatened federal funding yet, but we don't know quite yet. But the different distinction here is it is not local responsibility to enforce federal law.
Right.
We don't enforce IRS violations. We don't enforce that stuff. We're supposed to stick with local or state ordinances.
There's more to talk about on this. We'll also talk about Roy Cooper's budget coming up in a few minutes. And lo and behold, a Republican has suggested a commission to draw voting districts and not politicians. We'll talk about that, too. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Elvis Costello and the Imposters Sunday, June 21st at the Charlotte Metro Credit Union Amphitheater. Tickets available today, 10 a.m. at livenation.com. And Gardner Webb University, committed to preparing students for professional and personal success around the corner and around the world. Now accepting summer and fall applications at gardner-webb.com. Vermont.edu. With early spring, the pollen count isn't the only thing rising. Home prices in Charlotte are too. In fact, they reached an all-time high earlier in the spring, back in December when it was warm too. And the weather has nothing to do with this. The inventory of available homes is at an historic low. Mortgage rates are still low but ready to rise. And with rising prices, buyers are worried that if they don't buy now, they may miss out, price themselves out of the market. The state of real estate and some advice for those thinking of moving Monday on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Attorney General Jeff Sessions under fire over Russia contacts, President Trump before Congress, SpaceX, and the moon. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The news roundup continues with On Point from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the weekly news roundup with Ann Doss Helms, who is a education reporter, among other things, but mostly education reporter for the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Michael Tomsic, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News, all gathered around our Spirit Square news roundup table. We put a special table in here on Friday.
It's beautiful.
And, thank you very much. And several of our panelists during the public conversation that we had on WFAE earlier this week took issue with the way the president is painting immigrants with a broad and unflattering brush. And on that same night, President Trump spoke to a joint session of Congress in a kind of State of the Union moment. North Carolina Representative Alma Adams and some other House members invited immigrants and refugees to the House chamber to hear that speech. Why, and did it have any impact at all? And how did they get in?
Well, I think everybody is allowed to bring guests. And Alma Adams chose a young woman named Sil Gonzo. She is from Argentina originally, and she works with a group called Our Bridge for Kids, which supports refugee and immigrant children. And Sil had not been known to me, I think was not widely known in the community until the election. And she and a handful of other parents who I believe knew each other from their preschool kids said, "We're going to hold a rally for Love Wins Charlotte." And it was specifically, they were not calling out Trump's name, but they were saying, "We're not about singling out groups." And that is the kind of thing that you saw in the speech, even though Tuesday night's speech from the president was not the kind of, you know, bad hombres and murderers and rapist rhetoric that we heard during the campaign. He did talk a lot about crime, and he was talking about the violence in Chicago and segued immediately from that into, "And I am forming this group called Victims of Immigrant Crime." There was an E on it for voice. I don't remember what the E was. But, you know, just as if crime in America was about immigrants doing this crime. Right. And as Tom stated, there's no doubt some immigrants are doing some crime, but that's not where the violence in America is coming from.
And in fact, what you normally see in immigrant communities are lower crime rates than with the population as a whole. And that's nationwide.
And statistically in Charlotte, of the people that get arrested either by CMPD or end up in the sheriff's jail where they do ask about your status, are we discovering that the immigrant crime rate is the same, lower than, higher than the native-born population? Do we know?
I don't know specifics for Charlotte, but I do know that overall, as I just said, immigrant crime in immigrant communities tends to be lower than in the population as a whole.
And you want to think about how you define crime too, because I think immigrants, especially undocumented immigrants, are much more likely to be stopped for driving without a license or something like that. Because if you're going
and that's
to drive,
part that's part of the problem with these executive orders, because they're so broad, the crime could be crossing the border without.
Well, and it's.
Papers.
Yeah, and it's not just executive orders anymore. I mean, that's just one phase of what's happened. What we are also seeing are directives directly from the Department of Homeland Security that lay out how those executive orders are to be implemented. That's where the rubber meets the road here. And those directives, the memos that they're putting out, do in fact vastly increase the number of people that are slated for priority deportation. Under the Obama administration, the catchphrase was felons, not families. Under these new guidelines, it can be for almost anything. I mean, literally almost all of the 11 million people here illegally in this country could be seen as priority deportations. The sole pocket that still remains as not a priority are the Dreamers, you know, participants the DACA program.
Were I a member of this group of people who are here with undocumented, I would certainly be nervous and fearful of what's going on right now because there's so many
And this is why it's so hard for reporters to sort out, too, because, you know, from whenever it was 3 weeks or so ago when we started seeing on social media, you know, there are checkpoints, there are mass arrests in East Charlotte, and that was exaggerated. But when we went to the ICE local office and they said, no, no, there's nothing like that happening, nothing unusual is going on. And then now you do keep reading that there are, you know, there was an article in the New York Times this week that was talking about how that they were more empowered, more
real
ready
shift in tone, right?
Yeah, yeah. That there clearly is a different tone of enforcement, but nailing down what it is and how it's playing out has proven.
Well, the other thing.
That was my point. How is it playing out with those who are not in that community? Is this being received well by the American citizenry at large?
Well, I don't know about the American citizenry at large, but I will tell you politically, just from watching this week, it's really interesting some of the reactions. You know, some of the politicians said that while they're empathetic, they don't understand why people are coming to them for things that they have no control over. There was frustration about that. And then at the same time, let's look at just within Charlotte. City council probably has the least influence. You'd have more with the school board and with the county commissioners, and they've really heard comparatively very little. And then at the same time, one more layer to the onion, there were people who told me they were frustrated with Mayor Roberts because she had made statements on her Facebook posting and elsewhere about her concerns that ICE was being overzealous, and they thought that by saying that, mm-hmm. that Mayor Roberts made it seem as though city council had more influence than it does, and that brought on saw Monday night.
Talked about how this is playing out. I think that gets to the divided America and the social media again. I suspect that there are some people who are seeing massive amounts of traffic about how bad this is, about how the president's going in the wrong direction, about how these are our neighbors and friends and not bad hombres. And I suspect there's an equally large group of Americans saying, about time. I do think there's wide consensus that we ought to reform immigration. If you could take all the sort of drama out of it, there would be a lot of consensus that we could make the system work better.
And I think that's an important point because Trump was very clear about this when he ran mm-hmm. and he won. So it would not be a stretch at all to assume that the folks who elected him were like, great, he's doing what he said he was going to do.
But they're a minority.
Yes, but again, again, you're talking about the American populace as a whole. They may be a minority of the electorate or the people who voted, but they're still a sizable chunk of the population.
That's a good point, that they're a portion of the people who voted. A lot of people didn't vote, period, one way or the other. Last week, Governor Roy Cooper proposed 5% teacher pay raises for each of the next 2 years. This week, he laid out his budget priorities and called for the budget to grow by a little more than 5% or $1 billion increase in spending. And here's how he described his budget.
It lives within our means without raising taxes or fees and cutting services. We are catching up with investments in education all the way from birth through our community colleges and our universities.
So the governor bragged his is a budget that both Republicans and Democrats can get behind. Within 5 seconds,
that's about right.
Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger called it reckless. So is it dead on arrival?
Well, I think the first thing to note here, and this is still one of my favorite stories, former Senator Tom Apodaca used to refer to the governor's budget as a wonderful doorstop. The governor's budget that he was talking about was his fellow Republican, Pat McCrory. Right. So when you stop and think about it, there are really three budgets that come out, you know, every time. And the governor's budget is the least important of the three. It is his guidance. It's basically a wish list, what he would do if he had the purse strings, but he doesn't.
Right.
So dead on arrival. You know, it's just – let's just say it's not quite as important.
Well, he puts these –
How about gasping for air? Would that be good?
The governor puts these budgets –
Pleasant has life.
He puts these budgets out, and I guess if you like it, if you're a citizen and you like what he says, there's – He's put it on the masthead, so maybe you'll support it and you'll call your Republican representative in the legislature and say, I like this, I like that. In terms of education, aside from the 5% per year teacher pay increase, he has a lot of extra spending for education. What does he want to do, Ann?
Well, he wants to increase pre-kindergarten slots, I believe, by about 4,700 spots, and I think that is something that has a chance. I think the teacher raises, that's going to happen in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Probably expanding pre-kindergarten. He wants to eliminate the opportunity scholarships, the vouchers that send kids to private schools, and that's $35 million over the next 2 years. That's not going to happen. The Republican General Assembly is very bought into vouchers, and the sort of the whole national push. Vouchers are trending at the moment. So
even with that study that came out showing vouchers are highly ineffective.
Exactly. Right. The Fordham Institute, a pro-voucher organization, released a report that shows that vouchers have failed miserably. In what way? What were they talking about?
That you are not documenting any better performance. And it is challenging to document sometimes because you don't have parallel, but that there was no clear academic benefit to.
Not only no benefit, they were going down. Yeah, they were going down compared to when they were.
So these are kids. Let's be clear about this. These are kids or parents who get money from the government to pay for private school education. And when they get the kids in those private schools, their performance lowers.
Yep, their academic performance. And there are people who would say, but they're getting a religious education. They're getting a safer environment. They're getting something the family feels better about.
Is that the school's fault, or is it because they don't belong there in the first place?
I think that would be an individual. I'm not sure what you mean by don't belong there in the first place.
Well, in other words, they're academically not prepared to be there, but their money is good. So they took the money and they took the kid, and he's in a class.
Well, a voucher's not going to get you into Charlotte Country Day or Providence Day School or anything. Those are expensive. Those are selective. So the schools that are churning out the kids that are on the Harvard track are not, for the most part, taking vouchers unless this is an extraordinarily talented student. So if you have a voucher in North Carolina, it's for $4,200. That's not your top tier on tuition. So you are probably going to a church-sponsored school, which may be great, may be very well-intentioned, but not so high academically. And you know that may or may not actually change your prospects.
To the extent that the Observer, this was very interesting. They ran a column by Charlie Jeter, who is now lobbying for the school system, but is
former
a
Republican.
Former Republican who mentioned.
Still a Republican, former Republican legislator.
Former Republican lawmaker who mentioned in this column that he had voted for vouchers, and said flat out, look, they don't work. Now, obviously, he has a vested interest being a lobbyist for the school system, but it is a really interesting little trail right there in terms of state policy on vouchers.
Okay. So in addition to money for education, the governor's budget also includes money for pay raises for state employees. How much?
It's a formula here. It's 2% or $800 pay bump, whichever is greater, plus a $500 one-time bonus. There's also a cost of living increase for state retirees of, I believe, 1.5%. Governor Cooper calls it the single largest pay increase for state employees in a decade. Plus, and just to go back to education.
And in truth, they haven't gotten a big pay raise in a long time.
Yeah, it's one of these things you see time and again.
It was mostly bonuses under McCrory, right?
Yeah.
That's what they were doing, and one-time money.
If you follow that trail, that you normally saw about a 2% pay increase suggested in passing in the House budgets the last couple of years. The Senate said no way. So they ended up compromising on this kind of one-time bonus thing. Another thing, just to go back to these raises this is the principal pay raise, I think, is important too, because we've heard a ton about teacher pay raises on all over the scale, but administrators have not received a sizable pay increase in years. So Governor Cooper is calling for more than a 6% pay raise for principals and other administrative staff. That is something that the Republican legislature has said they do see as a priority. They just wanted to get teachers going first. So I'm curious to see if that also has traction when the House and Senate start doing their budgets.
And Governor Cooper also is now advocating expanding Medicaid to cover an additional 624,000 individuals in the state. If the former Republican governor and Republican legislature refuse to accept federal funding for the expansion of Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, leaving lots of North Carolinians without the opportunity to sign up for Obamacare, are they likely to expand Medicaid in the twilight of the Affordable Care Act? Michael?
No chance.
Thank you.
That's thank you and good night. That is a part of the budget that is without question dead on arrival. State lawmakers are suing Governor Cooper over his attempt to do this because we passed a state law a couple of years ago that forbid anyone other than the state legislature from getting to decide on Medicaid expansion. All of this is a moot point anyway. I mean, Republicans, as we speak, are final in Congress are finalizing their or are trying to finalize their attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare. All of the Republican plans out there, like there are differences between this and that. None of them maintain the Medicaid expansion. There's no chance that House Republicans allow the Medicaid expansion to remain as part of the repeal and replacement of Obamacare.
Well, so, but there are governors who are upset and who have said that they don't want any reduction. So it could be, it may not be exactly the same, but you could still have expanded coverage.
You know what? I got to go with Michael on this one, Eric, quite honestly, because the best thing they're talking about is block grants, but those block grants can be used by states in any way they see fit. Every governor who has complained about it has one single problem. They don't write laws. So well, Congress has a lot more of the control here.
Why put this proposal in your budget?
Because that's a public statement to say, and he campaigned on this. He said that it would bring not only better health care to rural areas, but it would also bring a number of jobs to rural areas. And so this has been a campaign theme for him. Look, everybody in the governor's office has to know exactly what Michael just said, which is there's no way this is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, this was a way for him to, as soon as he took office, show to the people who voted for him, I'm trying to fulfill this campaign promise, even though our state legislature isn't going to let it happen and Congress is going to take away the funding that would allow it to happen, even if our state lawmakers were cool with it.
So Phil Berger doesn't like this budget, but he also said it will return us to the days of high taxes and multi-billion dollar deficits. True?
No. I mean, no, because Phil Berger and the Republicans control the legislature. And again, guess who writes the laws? It's this is a constant trope that we've seen.
Well, his budget doesn't run a deficit, first of all. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a great point. You're absolutely right.
That would be the first point.
But the second point is that this is just a constant theme that we've heard from the Republican leaders in the General Assembly that, any time there's a reference to Governor Cooper or any kind of plan that he proposes –
And I would go back even farther. I mean, as Tom pointed out a minute ago, the Senate has been upset about Republicans in the House in previous years trying to spend more money. So the Republican state Senate is just very, very anti-spend.
Okay. I think the only part of that you could argue with is high taxes, because it depends on what your definition of high is. He's not calling for a tax increase, but perhaps if you're a corporate citizen who's looking forward to a big cut, then it's too high now.
And let's remember, though, that North Carolina corporate tax rates have gone from 6.9% to 3% over the span of 4 years.
All right. Here's something that came out of nowhere this week. Well, actually, it came out of Raleigh. Same thing. Where a leading House Republican is pushing a nonpartisan commission, not politicians, to draw North Carolina's voting districts. It's Chuck McGrady of Hendersonville. Is he a lone wolf?
No, and that's what makes this so interesting. So the four primary sponsors of this bill are all Republicans. One of them is the House Majority Leader. It's also got fairly substantial Democratic support. It's got support from, as an example, Chaz Beasley, who's a representative from Mecklenburg County. Mm-hmm. It's also got Craig Horn, who's a Republican representative from Union County.
Former Governor Martin, a Republican. Former Charlotte Mayor Richard Vinroot, a Republican, are also in favor.
Yeah, but those folks have consistently been calling for nonpartisan redistricting. What makes this significant is it seems as if it has a large amount of support that's bipartisan in the House. What could be tricky, though, so Senator Jeff Jackson, who's from the Charlotte area, I talked to him yesterday. He loves this bill. He's planning on filing a companion bill in the Senate, but he says it will be very difficult to get Republican sponsors in the Senate. But this is at least the bill that has seen the most support from what we know so far that would try to fix this pervasive, right, perpetual headache, court-suing problem of how we draw our district.
Of course, the problem here is that the Republicans were all in favor of this when the Democrats controlled the legislature. Now, the Democrats are all in favor because they're out of power. Has this been successfully done in other states?
There have been changes that, at the very least, have brought down legal costs. I think the verdict to some degree is still out on exactly how effective it is, but it's unquestionably better than the current system.
Okay, we now have a price tag for busing for choice. We also have a blue line delay to talk about. And yes, HB2 is on the list. Another repeal attempt. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNCC Department of Music presenting Requiem of Solace, featuring Brahms' German Requiem and the premiere of Jocelyn Hagen's Facets. March 17th at Robinson Hall. Info at arts.uncc.edu. Tom Ashbrook and his guests will continue the weekly news roundup with the national news coming up in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. A look at Attorney General Jeff Sessions under fire over Russian contacts, President Trump before Congress, SpaceX, and moon travel. We're sending Tom Bullock on the first flight. Just want you to know that. On Point's weekly news roundup coming up at 10. And we will continue ours in a few minutes. You can join us at Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks and use the hashtag WFAE Roundup.
The business environment in this country could change a lot in the next couple of years. How it's going to change, though, is the question.
Companies are dealing with uncertainty. It's like they're standing on a beach and looking at a tsunami kind of coming their way.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. The new rush of corporate strategizing, wargaming, and lobbying coming up next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in the midst of our weekly news roundup with Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Michael Tomsic from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock, also from WFAE News. We're going to move on, but before we do, Michael Tomsic has one more point he wants to make on this redistricting thing.
So Michael? To the average person listening, this may sound like some kind of, you know, esoteric arguments over lines on a map, but the reason this is so important is because essentially, this is why we have a country that is more and more getting polarized, where people who are running only care about their primary. So if you're a Democrat, you get swayed way to the left. If you're a Republican, you get swayed way to the right. And then we have all of this, you know, compromise becomes a nasty word as opposed to something that's how our democracy works. And to give you some data on it, so political scientists generally consider a district to be competitive if the margin between the winner and the runner-up is within 10%. By that measure, slightly over 90% of the state House and Senate districts were not competitive in November. And that's according to State Board of Elections data. That fundamentally means that these people do not care about their general election. So that's this redistricting problem is absolutely part of the polarization problem that we are having as a country. And that's why these types of bills, though facing a difficult path to passing, because it would mean the people in power who get to draw the
have
lines
to give up power.
Have to give it up. Yeah. But that's why it's an important concept.
It seems like the General Assembly things have been going so smoothly, but anyway. Yeah.
All right. Unlike the attitude before the opening of the south end leg of the Blue Line, people in Noda up near the university have been very excited about the arrival of the Blue Line extension in August of this year. But unfortunately, it's not going to arrive in August. There's been a little delay, March of 2018 or beyond. And when WFAE Sarah D'Elia asked Joe Kuhlman, who owns the Evening Muse in Noda, how he felt about the delay, this was his response.
Not good. very frustrated. You know, it's like Christmas and then being told, nope, it's going to be 7 months from now. It's even to the point where artists that are traveling through are like, hey, is that construction done yet? Because it's been here for 3 years. You know, GPS still isn't updated to not send people down 36th Street.
So is Noda the worst hit area by this delay because they have construction going on in anticipation of the arrival?
Well, no, I think UNCC is the worst hit of this area because they were going to have this in time for school, but certainly that doesn't make it any more fun for Noda to suffer through the delay as well.
Why the delay?
The delay is because they need 5 months of testing once every – the line is 91% built, but software and the final – segments are going to take too long to allow for that 5 months of testing. What the head of CATS has said is that it may not be as long as March of 2018, but it's certainly not going to be August of 2017.
Am I to understand that despite the delay and the disappointment surrounding that, the project is actually under budget?
Yes, the project is under budget, and it is also still on time because the federal grant required that it be opened by March of 2018. CATS saw a chance to accelerate the schedule, and that is when they started going into this promise of delivering by August 2017. But the problem here, Mike, is that once people heard August 2017 and they heard it over and over again, nobody's thinking about March 2018 is a good thing.
Okay. We now know what CMS's expansion of busing to increase diversity in magnet schools is going to cost. It's going to meet the cost estimate, actually, of $6 million. Why so much?
Well, you know, when people talk about busing, they have this negative reaction because they assume it means being bused somewhere they don't want to go. And when we hear about choice, which is the big theme everywhere, we feel happy about that because we're American consumers and we like choice. But the reality that CMS is confronting is that when you offer meaningful choice, it involves an awful lot of busing. And so what we're actually seeing is kind of a little slice of this. During the recession, when you just didn't have the money, they said, for these 15 schools that draw from really broad areas, if you want to keep coming to these schools, you are going to have to get your kids to a central shuttle stop at a school in your general vicinity, and then the bus will take a bunch of them there.
And they stopped doing that?
They stopped that this year, and they knew going in, you know, that's why they said we're – and the state actually pays for most of the busing, but when you start expanding it to a certain level – and, again, we're talking about a county that is spread over more than 500 square miles. That's a lot of busing.
No, you reported that to make busing for choice work, they had to add the equivalent of 10,000 miles of bus runs a day, and you point out in your article about this, that's the equivalent of two round-trip trips – to Los Angeles a day.
I know. That was stunning to me to see those miles. I'd sort of gotten the $6 million in my head. And, you know, government money, it's, you know, a million here, a million there. But that is a lot. And that's the difference between they were doing about 7,000 miles a day just with these shuttle stops where parents had to do a good bit of the driving. And so to be able to go into those neighborhoods. But the thing with those shuttle stops was it only worked if you had parents who had the flexibility and the transportation to – whether it's your own child or a carpool, you know, let's grab the kids and get them to the shuttle stop.
So this money mostly comes from the state, the $6 million?
No, the $6 million was all local money.
Local money.
There's even more than that for the whole busing system.
What could we do if we didn't bus for choice and put that money in the classroom?
That's an interesting question because clearly the cheapest transportation model is strictly neighborhood schools. Draw a line around the school, send the bus through, scoop up all the kids and take them there. And actually, in theory, almost everybody agrees with the best thing is an excellent neighborhood school.
But I mean, is $6 million enough to make a difference if you stop this stuff and just made the schools better using the $6 million so that people wouldn't want or wouldn't need to have the choice to go across town?
Well, one of the things they're having very early discussions about the coming year's budget. And one of the big unknowns is how much more busing in addition to that $6 million. But they said that it would take about $6 million – $5 to $6 million to increase the local teacher supplement by 10%. Mm-hmm. And again, we're not talking about their whole pay. We're talking about that chunk that Mecklenburg County money adds on, but that would make our schools more competitive with a Wake County or with a Chapel Hill.
So can we
system.
Afford this? Are we going to proceed, continue to do this? Is that what's the
decision? We are deeply committed to a lot of
busing
for
even though we can't
choice.
Find enough bus drivers.
That's another part of the challenge, and it's a big part of the challenge.
Uh-oh.
They actually had to pair off, you know, 30 buses from this year's plan because they couldn't find the drivers. And they're saying, you know, we're doing things to help. We've raised the pay a little this year. But the bottom line is you're competing with, say, the CATS buses, which is a more regular schedule. If you're driving a school bus, you have a chunk of time in the morning and a chunk of time in the afternoon. And at Christmas break, you're not getting paid. And over the summer, you're not getting paid.
Why don't they use the CATS buses?
Well, I don't think that the CATS buses has enough buses to pull off and drive school routes. There are in a few of these cases, like when students go to a small high school on a college campus, I am fairly certain that in some of those cases, CMS is actually paying for a bus pass for those kids.
Okay. You win the prize, Eric Spanberg, because you get to talk about HB2 this week.
Oh, I thought I was getting a bus ride.
No, no, you get to drive the bus. More movement on
God
that
help
front.
Us all.
Booby prize.
More movement on that front, this time from Charlotte, among elected officials and tourist and trade interests. What did they do? People from Charlotte and the tourist and trade businesses are
yes, and also this is a bill by Representative McGrady, who Michael was talking about with the redistricting. So there was a bipartisan bill introduced, HB 186, last week to repeal HB 2. This is, I don't know, the five zillionth time that this has been attempted. The difference here is that you do have Republicans and Democrats taking it fairly, not only seriously, but they seem to be in some agreement, and they brought up a number of local politicians from Charlotte, tourism executives, as you mentioned,
to make a public plea for the rest of the legislature to truly make, maybe not a last ditch, but a serious attempt to repeal HB2 before we have all these decisions on sporting events.
And how are we
doing? It seemed like they were having a pretty good day. And by that evening, yeah. Speaker Tim Moore spoke to our friend Nick Oxner at WBTV. And Tim Moore said that the governor needs to keep his nose out of HB 186. And so that undermined what Representative McGrady and others were saying, which is this is not a take it or leave it proposition. We are willing to talk and to negotiate on this. So now we seem to be stuck in the same place we've been stuck for quite some time.
All right. There were 100 shots fired this past Saturday night uptown in a neighborhood area of uptown Charlotte. You heard about it on the news. It was 30 minutes in advance of the final of the men's final in the CIAA championship. I know that police are still investigating, but this is the kind of thing, had it happened, I don't know, 5 years ago, that this would have been the lead story on every news organization for weeks. And this was on the news that night and the next couple of days, and it's been peripherally mentioned, and it just disappeared. And no one – I know police are investigating, but nobody's really talking about this. Why not?
There's been a little bit of talk about whether this threatens the relationship between the CIAA and the city. All of the evidence so far is that it doesn't. I'm a little surprised that there hasn't been more of a public relations effort or campaign by the city and the CIAA to reassure people. You know, there have been 4 years in a row that there have been crimes
peripherally connected.
And I understand, you know, that on the conference obviously cannot control everything going on around them in the city. But this looks to be more than a coincidence, and it seems like there needs to be probably a little more public reassurance that steps are being taken to try and minimize.
Last year, shots were fired into cars and into a hotel.
Yeah.
With an AK-47.
50 shots, I believe.
Yep.
This year, 100 shots at a party around the tent area in advance of this game. I mean...
And you had the party...
Been apoplectic about this 5 years
ago. Well, yeah, I think you're about to bring up, Eric, the 2 years ago when
P. Diddy?
Yeah, it was at a couple of people were shot.
Was it the Sheraton? I can't remember the hotel.
It was an
uptown hotel. There were shots. And then there was also a circumstance out at the Music Factory in the last couple of years that was tied to not CIAA sanctioned, but CIAA themed or related events. So, yes, there is a situation that needs to be addressed.
And it's interesting, we were talking last week about potentially lower attendance and whether there was some CIAA tournament fatigue going on with local people. And you wonder if that's an element, because most people who want to come in and have a good time do not want to get caught up in something like that.
Exactly. All right, let's move on to something that's really also surprising to me. Only Blue Cross Blue Shield, Michael, remains standing, I believe, in most parts of the state with regard to the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. And that's because of losses by other insurance companies, because only sick people were signing up. And to make this thing work, you had to have healthy people in the exchanges as well. But you say that Blue Cross Blue Shield in North Carolina has had dramatic profits. Really?
Dramatic increase in profit.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
Which, when you start from losing money and then just barely squeaking out even, then 185.
So if Obamacare is in a death spiral and because the insurance companies can't make money, is this the outlier?
No, that's an oversimplification. I mean, what it boils down to is your big national carriers who are used to setting policies that have these big networks, and they've just never really I should also first say we're talking about a tiny slice of the overall American health insurance market. Mm-hmm. So Blue Cross, for example, which is the dominant player in North Carolina, less than 10% of their customers are quote-unquote Obamacare customers. So most folks who get it through their employer, who have Medicare or have Medicaid, this doesn't impact them. All right. So this tiny little sliver is the piece of the market that's gone through the biggest changes. And most of your big national companies, your Aetnas, your United Healthcares, Coventry, which is a subsidiary of one of those, some that have dropped out of North Carolina, these are traditionally not players who are really great at skimping by with low-cost plans. The local insurers have always been better at that because they know their states or their communities better. They're used to these lower-cost, narrow-network kinds of plans. So what the death knell would be is if you have a Blue Cross, for example, who, like you said, Mike, now is the only insurance company in almost all of the state on the Obamacare exchanges. If you have those types of insurance companies start dropping out, then yeah, the entire exchange concept would be dead.
Well, and from a consumer point of view, it's not great that there's now no competition, that there's one Obamacare subsidized provider. And that the reason they're making profits is because the rates have gone way up for consumers, and so have the deductibles. So if you're arguing
that
Obamacare—
That's been going on for years.
It has, and it happened well before Obamacare. Yes. And so when employers say it's just Obamacare that's causing your insurance rates to go up, I'm very skeptical.
It's not true.
And it's also worth pointing out, so one of the changes that happened under Obamacare as well that has not gotten a ton of reporting is insurance companies are now required to prove how much they're spending, like percent of premiums they bring in, they are spending on actual health services. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross, which, as Ann just mentioned, has been jacking up premiums for the past couple of years on the exchanges, is still very safely in the requirements for how much of their premium dollars they're spending on healthcare services. So what this comes down to is essentially there are the population of people who are served on these exchanges are so much sicker than folks thought they would be,
right,
that the premiums just have to be higher in order to meet that basic math equation.
But they're making a profit. It's
right.
Working.
Now, this is the first year they have made a profit or a significant profit in right. 3 years.
Yeah. We know that Kannapolis is going to be building a $37 million sports complex. We know that Gastonia is going to build the most unique ballpark in the world, according to Eric.
It floats. Journal.
That's not a small promise, is it?
No. All of that's important, but this is something that caught my eye. The Charlotte Business Journal reports this week that the Queen City is one of 50 bakery capitals of America, according to residential real estate data website Find the Home. This finding is based on Yelp data on the number of bakeries, the percentage of bakeries with four or more stars as average rating of bakeries compared to the average rating of all restaurants. And Eric, at that point, I had reached my three article limit for this 30-day period without a subscription. I hit the paywall. What do you know about this?
I didn't write the story, but I will tell you that I am consuming as much bread as possible to keep our bakery rating strong. So that's my expertise there.
And before we go, I want to wish a fond farewell and good luck to Michael Tomczyk, who is going off to greener pastures and who has to leave now because he has to buy more suits for this new job he's taking. Good luck to you. Sir.
Mike, I really appreciate
we
that.
Will
it's
miss
been a
you.
Pleasure.
We will miss you desperately. You're the Medicare Blue Cross Blue Shield Brain Trust at WFAE. Michael Tomczyk, Tom Bullock, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.